Welcome to the Anthony Plogue Podcast. I'm Tony Plogue, and today we'll be speaking with the iconic principal trumpet of the Cleveland Orchestra, Michael Sacks. In addition to playing in the orchestra, Michael is music director of the Strings Music Festival in Steamboat Springs, Colorado. He's highly involved in a national brass ensemble and has been very important in producing their marvelous Gabrielli recording. He's the head of winds and brass at the Cleveland Institute of Music and has given numerous master classes around the world. And in addition, he's the author of Daily Fundamentals for Trumpet, The Orchestral Trumpet, and The Complete Mahler Symphonies for Trumpet. That makes me tired just saying that. So welcome to the session, Michael.
Thanks, Tony.
So my first question, with all of those things, any of those would make a career for most people. And I'd sort of like to go deep on this. How do you do all of that? How do you juggle your time so that you can get everything done and not go crazy?
You know, it's an interesting question. I mean, you and I have known each other for a very, very long time. I mean, we first met when I was 17 in my senior year of high school in Santa Monica. And I've always had a lot of curiosity and a lot of drive in any number of things that I've been interested in, whether it was trumpet, whether it was sports, history, any number of different things I've been interested in. I guess the best way for me to describe it is that when I decided, a little bit later in life, more like when I was about 20, to really pursue this, my ideal was to kind of look at, a number of the different guys that I really admired, people like Tom Stevens, people like Bud Herseth, people like Phil Smith, Maurice André. These were guys who did, a lot of different things. And, being a big baseball fan, I guess I think about, the greatest baseball players, they call them a five-tool guy. And I know you know that is, somebody who hits for average, hits for power, runs fast, fields great, and has a gun for an arm. And I kind of felt like whatever I wanted to do, I wanted to be that five-tool guy. And when I decided I wanted to go into music and play the trumpet specifically in an orchestra, I kind of wanted to be the equivalent of a five-tool guy, somebody who played in an orchestra and played well in that setting, somebody who taught and did that with a modicum of success, who published books, who played, solo music and chamber music, and also had recordings of all those different things. And, that's just kind of the way I've always been, is that the deeper I've gotten into this, the more everything has kind of grown about 20 different heads and gone all these different directions, kind of fanned out like a tree and branches and more branches. And, the more I've gotten into, almost has kind of opened up other doors for me and interests, and really just that curiosity and that kind of ideal of being an eternal student is kind of what's driven me. And I guess, it's not that I don't sleep, but, I just really love my work. I mean, for me, when you say you play an instrument, I mean, it truly is playtime for me. This truly is something that I do because I've always loved it. And it's the reason I got into it in the first place.
Yeah, I was going to say, tell me about your mentality when you go into auditions. And just in general, it seems to me that you never actually had a problem with nerves. Is that correct?
Yes and no. I mean, like anyone, I mean, when I was younger, I would get uptight about performances and, feeling pressures and, a lot of the wrong thought process, worrying about who's in the audience, worrying about what they're thinking, trying to impress somebody, basically all the wrong avenues to go down to be successful. And,
right.
It took me a while to grow out of that and to kind of realize that, my preparation for auditions, there's a lot that went into it. I mean, for my audition here in Cleveland in particular, first of all, I wasn't initially invited. I guess David Zauter, the longtime personnel manager and legendary second trumpet player in Cleveland, saw my resume and that I didn't have any principal experience, even though I had won my job in Houston and been in the finals for two other positions. The last two positions that had been open, around that time as well, he felt because I didn't have any principal experience that, I wasn't the guy for them. So I had you and four other guys call Dave and then, had those recommendations. And then Dave did send an invite to me. And my first thing was, you know, I thought, well, okay, I don't sound anything like Bernie. I don't play anything like Bernie. So, and I, of course, I'd been listening to Cleveland Zell recordings and Mazel recordings and knew Bernie's playing well. So I started listening to those recordings more. And for about a week, I was trying to play like Bernie. And all of a sudden, I just, everything felt off. I just was totally off center. I was missing stuff I normally wouldn't miss. And it just, everything felt wrong. And then finally, I just took a step back and I thought, wait a minute. I shouldn't be Bernie. I shouldn't try to walk in somebody else's shoes. I need to be the best who I am. And if I'm right for the job, I'm right for the job. If I'm not, so be it. But I need to do whatever I have to in order to line myself up. It's like the Olympics, to run like a 100-meter dash in the Olympics. Those 10 seconds and all those years getting ready for those 10 seconds, that to focus yourself and time it so that in those 10 seconds, you are at your optimal best.
You know, can I interrupt just for a minute?
20 minutes.
Let me interrupt just for a minute, because I just heard a recent podcast with Hugh Jackman and Tim Ferriss, and he talks about the 85% rule. And this is exactly what you're talking about, because I remember Alan Dean saying that he heard from somebody that the reason why you won that audition was that you played smarter than everybody else. You didn't try to blow the walls down. You just played the way you play, you know, which is great. Mm-hmm. And Hugh Jackman was talking about this 85% rule. And he was talking about Carl Lewis, the great sprinter, since you're talking about a 100-yard dash. And mm-hmm. that the difference between Carl Lewis and all the other runners was he'd look at this one person studied these runners for about a year on all the tapes. And he would be sort of in the back of the pack at about, let's say, 40 meters or something. And then by the end, he would have blown the field away. And he said the difference between him and the other runners was for the last 50 or 60 meters, he just ran normal. He didn't try to run faster. And the other guys sort of faded, and he just kept his regular routine and then made it to the end as the winner. And that sounds exactly like what you were doing.
Yeah. Well, in a lot of ways, exactly what you're describing and what Alan Dean describes is exactly what I did. I stayed within myself. I didn't try to be Superman and blow the walls down or try to project what I thought they would want to hear. I was trying to be the best version of myself. Mm-hmm. And that really came down to, again, thorough and meticulous, no stone unturned preparation. I mean, sitting there with scores, with parts, you know, really going through not just the excerpts, but going through the entire piece. And then going and then getting the orchestra's prior season, their current season, and what they had announced for the next season, and going through all of that repertoire. And then getting, at that point, there was a list from 1970 to 81 of 43 auditions or 45 auditions in the frequency of which pieces were asked on those auditions. So I had this giant list. I got all the parts I could possibly get off of that list, and I had this giant stack on my dining room table of all the stuff not on the list that Cleveland sent. And every night, I would go through as many of those as I could. And then the pieces that I didn't know, either I get a recording or Dick Schaefer, who was the longtime second trumpet player in Houston at that time, lovely guy, was a huge supporter, was one of the few guys that knew that I was taking this audition. And I would go to Dick's house and I'd say, hey, listen, you know, could you show me what are they looking for in this piece? And he'd explain, or he'd give me a recording or tell me what recording to get. And I wanted it to be like, instead of the list that they sent out for the audition, I wanted to go in prepared to play standard orchestra repertoire. That was my mindset, that I didn't care if they asked me Leonore 3 or they asked me Wozzeck or anything in between. Mm-hmm. It didn't matter. I felt like I was prepared to play. I was in conditioning. I was in the shape of my life. And mentally, I was prepared to play everything on the list from anything in those pieces and anything that orchestra had played over that season, the season before, the season to come, and anything that had been asked in any audition potentially. And that kind of mindset and that kind of preparation freed me in a lot of ways because, you know, I'd been working on this wide, wide range of expressiveness and really compartmentalizing that each piece I wanted to tell a story. I wanted to transport the listener in that moment into Petrushka, into Pictures, into Pines, into Scheherazade, into Mahler 5, and inhabit that piece for the and bring the audition committee into the piece that way. And, you know, that also freed me because I wasn't nervous. I felt prepared. I didn't care what they asked me. It's like they could ask me anything. And that kind of confidence goes a huge long way. And that's really the way I've prepared for everything that I do in the orchestra. Everything I do in the orchestra, I know exactly what I want to do every single note of that piece going into the first rehearsal. And it was the same thing with the audition, that I knew what I wanted to do with intention and with a compelling musical presence from the first note that came out of my horn.
So that incredible amount of preparation actually let you be totally free then when you played.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it released me. And that was something that I figured out when I was in school in New York. Because I remember it was very specifically, and I remember the date even, it was March 15th, 1985. I was 23 years old. I was playing principal on Strauss' Also Sprach Zarathustra.
Whoa. And, with the Juilliard Orchestra?
Yeah, with the Juilliard Orchestra. Uh-huh. And it was one of those things, I'd kind of had an epiphany about a month before where all of a sudden I figured something out about the way it feels when I moved my air, when I play, just playing softly, playing loudly. All of a sudden, it's like I got this depth in my sound and a control in soft and the loudest ends of the spectrum. And I remember sitting there and playing that show and just feeling like I was just like I'm talking to you right now. And it flew out of the horn. And it was at the end of that show, I just thought, really the first time I thought, okay, I think I can do this. I really think I can do this. And it was that kind of epiphany. But that was after, I mean, it's like that classic, cartoon or whatever, where you got the iceberg where it's a little bit sticking out of the water and there's a giant thing under the water,
mm-hmm.
you know, of what the iceberg is. And I just felt like that was kind of, I'd had moments like that leading up to it, but that was kind of an aha moment for me.
Yeah. It's interesting. Was like, okay. Interesting you mentioned an iceberg, because Hemingway said that great writing was like an iceberg, that 1/8 is above the surface and 7/8 is below the surface. And I guess in terms of preparation, all that is the same thing.
Oh, it's completely that way in anything that you've ever heard me do, that it's always been like that. And that goes back to my time with you and starting to understand what it takes, because, you know, I mean, I remember there were a few lessons I came in and I wasn't that prepared. And, you know, I mean, you were nice about it. You didn't rip me a new one, but yeah, you leaned on me kind of like a, you know, an older brother, just kind of like, hey man, you know, get your head out of your rear end and, you know, you're not doing what you need to be doing. Come on, you know, let's go. And, you know, you challenged me that way. And, you know, starting from then, it's something that, I mean, all of us are wired differently and motivate differently. And, you know, for me, that was kind of, you know, the way I learned to do stuff was just that I realized that, you know, if I was meticulously prepared, I wouldn't be nervous and I could be much more in the flow of things and ultimately much more successful. So I guess, you know, going back to your initial question, maybe about 20 minutes ago, I mean, sure, when I was younger, I would get very nervous for stuff. I mean, there was, oh my God, there was one audition I took where it got to the end. I was actually playing in the orchestra and I got cotton mouth and I was shaking and, you know, I was, nothing was coming out of the horn and I was dying in the middle of some stuff. I remember Shostakovich 5 I was playing and I'm just dying on it. And I thought to myself at that point, it's like, man, my career's over. I can't do this. And, you know, I got home and after being pretty down for about a week, I just decided to say, okay, let's take the opportunity to stop feeling sorry for myself and really look at what I was doing and why that happened. And I realized that, you know, it was all in my mind, that I had prepared, I was ready to go, but I created such a negative and incorrect mindset for that moment. And I had created I had heaped so much pressure on myself for that moment that I made it a completely daunting and unnecessarily impossible task. And it was that shift of mindset that really is what changed. And it so happens that the next audition I took was the Cleveland audition.
Wow. Okay. With Cleveland, in the last round, did you end up playing with a section?
No. No. No, the Cleveland audition, funny enough, was the shortest audition that I ever took.
Wow, that is really interesting.
The first thing...
You think it would be the opposite.
The first thing they asked was... Yeah, I know. The first thing they asked was Soul of Your Choice. And I always played second movement of Haydn because I felt like my sound was my calling card. I felt like my sound and my musicality and my the way I could spin a phrase on that was something that would separate me in a unique manner from all others. And so I always played second movement of Haydn. The next thing up was Leonore II, the offstage call. So I played that. Next thing after that was the beginning of Pictures. And then the next thing after that was the lick from Zarathustra. It's at, I think it's just a little bit after, I think it's 11 bars after number three, the bum, bum, beam, bum, beep, bum, beep, bum, beep, bum, beep, bum, beep.
Right, that so lick. The low G and the high G.
Yeah, and I just bombed that thing out. I played this fat as heck low G and just like cranked this like Pavarotti-esque, you know, at least in my mind, you know, upper G. And I was just like, you know, when I was younger, I get really amped. I mean, I'm a frustrated athlete. I love to play for the Dodgers. And I would get really amped. And I was, you know, and then the next thing I played was a Vel piano concerto. And I played it and I was still a little amped. And, I I was probably a little heavy with it. And I was about to ask him if I can do it again. And Christoph von Dohnányi, the music director at the time, right as I was taking a breath to ask them if I could play it again. And he said, excuse me, would you mind playing that again, but more leggero? And I was like, whew, you know, reprieve, you know, which is exactly what I wanted to do.
He was
and
in the first round? It. Sorry. He was
in the first round.
Wow.
Yeah.
I know. Yeah, well, there was no at all that the music director.
No, the Cleveland. The Cleveland Orchestra up until recently never had a screen. And the committee is the remaining principal brass players. I mean, all the principal brass players, the remaining members of the section, and now we have, I think, one or two, just random, you know, brass players for brass audition. So it's only brass players hearing this, and then the conducting staff and the music director is there from the first note to the last note, which is unique. It's still that way. We have a screen now for the prelim, but the makeup of the committee and the music director being there for the entire time is still intact, which I think is great. Because hearing somebody from the first round to second round, third round, however long it's going, you hear a trajectory of how somebody goes along. You know, it's important to have that continuity. For a music director to come in and just hear the finals, to me, doesn't give them the full picture that everybody, you know, has and that everybody's been given. And to me, the more information you have, the more access to what somebody's doing, the better. Right. But there's no screen, and he was there, and he asked me to do it again. So I did Ravel Piano Concerto again, the beginning, a lot more leggero, and I felt really good about it. And then the last thing was the second phrase going up to the high concert C in Parsifal, the prelude to Parsifal. And that was the prelim. And funny enough, the Haydn I play on my E-flat trumpet, the Leonore II I played on my E-flat trumpet, the Pictures I played on my C, the Zarathustra I played on my C, the Ravel I play on my D, and the Parsifal I play on my E-flat, which is, I'm not grabbing different horns very often. For anybody that knows me, I play C trumpet a lion's share of the time, either C or B-flat. And it's rare that I'll grab an E-flat or D trumpet, but it's ironic that the majority of my prelim was on my D E-flat trumpet.
Yeah, that's wild. That is, especially for a prelim.
And then the finals. The final started out with the entire Credo from B minor Mass, not just up to the high concert E, but really just they had me play the entire movement. Mm-hmm. And then the next thing was the beginning of Mahler 5, the lyrical passage at number 13 from the first movement of Mahler 5, and then the beginning of Shostakovich 1 and the soft muted solo from the third movement. And that was it.
And that was the finals. So, and there was only,
that was it.
Only two rounds.
That was it. That's all I played.
Huh?
Yep.
And did they tell you that day that you had won?
No, they didn't tell me that day. Well, really quickly, they brought me into Mr. Dohnányi's room and they said, you know, today you are the winner, but there's one other person we need to hear. We're going to hear them. This was on a Monday. We're going to hear them on Thursday. We'll call you on Thursday. That's basically what happened. They heard the other person, and then they called me on Thursday and offered me the job.
So Tuesday and Wednesday must have been very difficult days, I would think.
You know, it's really funny. Looking back on it, I would have thought they would have been too, but to a certain extent, I kind of felt like I put it all out there. I gave everything I got, and I just thought, you know what? I put my best foot forward. I've given him everything I've got. It's out of my hands. And I kind of let it go. And just thought, if it happens, it happens. If it doesn't, it doesn't. But there's nothing more I could have possibly done.
Mm-hmm.
And but it was funny. In the audition, David Zauter, who later became a very, very dear friend and really as much a father to me as my own father. David and I were very, very close, and I was really honored to be sitting next to him for my first 9 seasons here. But you know, Dave, of course, very much in his way, as I'm playing some of the stuff in the finals, or maybe it was the prelim. No, it was the finals. He came up toward the stage and he told me later, he wanted to see what your embouchure looked like. And, you know, he came up because he wanted to see my setup and wanted to see what it all looked like. And I remember I'm playing and this guy's walking up towards the stage. It's like, what is he doing? And then I finished the passage and he's just standing kind of right below me and just looking up and staring at me. He's like, all right.
I
thought it was funny.
Yeah, that was not disconcerting to you?
No. My sense with that, actually, it was in the finals. It was when I was playing the Mahler 5. At that point, I knew they were interested because I'd been advanced to the finals. So it's like, okay, these guys are interested. And I also had this view when I took auditions that if I advanced and they were interested, it was like I felt like I was a shark with blood in the water.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm sorry to just like go ADD on you a little bit, but going back to that Zarathustra performance at Juilliard, Mark Gould, who of course I studied with in New York.
Right, a great teacher.
Gould is always, what?
A great teacher.
Oh, he's a great teacher and, you know, was a wonderful companion, and you know, to have the two of you as my mentors, I couldn't have asked for more. I mean, really, it was you both complimented each other so well, and it was fabulous. But Gould has always told me that after the Zarathustra performance, he realized that he's always told me that that's when like me as the assassin was born. And that's kind of how I went about things in auditions. I felt like the further along I went, the more focused I got, the more charged up I got, the more I just went after it. And that's something that a lot of guys don't do. A lot of times I see people when I've seen auditions since, is that they get in the finals, they kind of start playing it safe and they recoil. And I leaned into it and I went further at it. I mean, it's just, you know, sensing that I was getting close. I wanted to close. I wanted to close the deal. I wanted to, you know, shut the door with this and get it. And that kind of determination always kind of drove me in those audition situations. And I feel like that's one of the things that got me over the finish line and still does when I perform.
You know, you're from Los Angeles. So do you remember the name Michael Cooper, who played for the Los Angeles Lakers?
Yeah, of course I remember Coop, man. Okay. Great six man.
Yeah, and a great, great defensive player. And so he always had to guard Larry Bird with the Boston Celtics. And there was a quote from Cooper that I saw in a book, and he said, "When you look into Bird's eyes at the end of a game, it's like looking into the eyes of an assassin." And that sounds exactly like what you're talking about. Yeah. It's time to close out the game.
That's exactly right. And I feel that way in my job, too. I mean, it's the kind of thing that, you know, growing up, the great players want the ball at the end of the game.
Right, right.
You know, Jordan, Bird, Magic, Kareem. You know, those are the guys, they want the ball. They're not shying away from it. And I wanted to be in a position where mentally I could be that guy. And I feel like I kind of became that guy. I felt very comfortable being that guy that, you know, in crunch time, you know, I'll carry the ball.
You know, I remember.
No problem with that.
Sorry, I'm interrupting. Go ahead.
No. Go ahead. I'm done.
I remember that you said your first year with the orchestra was going to tour in Europe, and they were scheduled to do Mahler's first, and Dognani wanted to change it to Mahler's fifth, and he asked you, is this going to be okay for you? And your response was something like, yeah, let's go for it. And I think a lot of people would say, well, wait until my second or third season, but you were like, yes, please.
No, yeah, they brought me in. It was November of my first season. And Zauder, you know, of course, personnel manager, and he waits until we're at the break for this rehearsal. I remember it was a Wednesday, and he goes, "Boss would like to see you." And I'm thinking, "Uh-oh, what?" You know, he just goes, "Follow me," and I walk in there, and there's and walk into Doc Nani's room, and there's Tom Morse, our executive director, and Zauder shuts the door behind us, and these three guys, and Zauder goes, "Sit down, young man." It's like, "Uh-oh, what I do now?" You know. And so Doc Nani starts to say, we're really thrilled with your playing, and you know, you sound fantastic. As you know, we're going to be going to Europe later this year, and you know, we're scheduled to do Mahler's first, but you know, given everything, we would like to change it to Mahler 5, and we wanted to just see if you'd be okay with that. And I kind of smiled and laughed. It was okay. I said, yeah, of course I'd be okay with it. It's great. Thank you. Uh-huh. You know, and Zauder and Tom Morse and Doc Nani start laughing, and Tom Morse looks at me and says, "Good, because it's already done."
Oh, that's great. I did not know that part of the story.
Yeah, but you know, but that, I mean, again, for those guys to show me that kind of support and that kind of confidence, man, that was such a giant boost. Just that small gesture, just wow. I mean, these guys have that kind of confidence in me to roll like that. And, you know, that's, your mindset is so much a part of success.
You know, I forgot to mention at the beginning that in addition to Cleveland Institute of Music, you also are teaching at Northwestern as well. Mm-hmm. So you're teaching a lot of different types of students. Do you see a lot of traits that they share and certain traits that you think are going to actually indicate to you that they're going to really have a great career?
The ones that I see are going to be successful, it's not, I know this is going to sound funny, it's not necessarily that they're going to be successful in music, but they're going to be successful in life.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times it ends up being music. But I feel as a teacher, I'm going to offer these kids a framework of, you know, understanding creative problem solving, understanding preparation and execution, understanding being thorough and meticulous with their fundamentals and how that supports all these other things, understanding the relationships of, you know, assimilating information and communication, understanding, you know, how listening and being a student and being curious and feeding that curiosity and not being satisfied necessarily with, I mean, having satisfaction, but not being satisfied like you've reached the goal and okay, whew, I can exhale and just kind of hang on my laurels, that there's always more room to go. That the students that I see doing that are going the extra mile, that are listening to more stuff, that are doing more than just what you're assigning them, those are the ones that I see as being ultimately successful in whatever they decide to put their mind to.
Right.
And for some of them, it's going to be music. For some of them, it's going to maybe be something else. But that's the main thing that I, you know, that I'm really looking for in a student is that kind of mindset and that kind of desire and that kind of motivation in whatever they're doing.
When Mark Lawrence was first joining the San Francisco Symphony, I think he was 25 years old, and he got a call from a father who said, "My son is a trombone player, and could he take lessons from you?" And Mark said, "Well, I'm really not teaching young kids." And he said, "Well, could he just play for you?" And Mark said, "Okay." So this kid played for Mark, and Mark said, "I'll take him." And this kid was Joe Alessi. And I asked Mark, I said, "What was Joe like as a student?" And Mark said, in the middle of the week, Joe would call him up and say, "I've already prepared everything you've given me. What else can I do to prepare?" And everything you're talking about today is about preparation and being methodical. And I remember you talking about your connection with John Williams, and you premiered the John Williams Trumpet Concerto, about how methodical he is in the way he approaches things. And you tend to think, again, these people are so off the charts talented that it just sort of flows. Music just flows out of him, or notes just flow out of a great player. But it's just being so methodical and so prepared day after day after day. It's not exciting stuff. It's not sexy stuff. It's just putting in the work in a very engaged way every day.
Now, there's nothing more important than what you just exactly said. And, you know, getting to work with John Williams was, again, I keep using this term, but one of the great honors of my life to get to spend time with him, to get to work with him. And, I mean, you look up Mention the Dictionary and you see a picture of John Williams. I mean, you will not find a more generous, kind, wonderful human being on the planet. And in every setting over the last, oh gosh, now 27 years, he is always like that. And, you know, I can't thank him enough for, you know, allowing me into, you know, his orbit, and, you know, for him to allow me into his process and to, in many ways showing me his process and the way he would work and the way he thought. And, you know, a funny little anecdote. One time I was at his house, what usually happened was he would send me sketches, and then I would be coming out to visit my folks in Santa Monica, and then I'd come see him. He lived just a couple blocks away from UCLA, so only about, 15 minutes from my folks' place. And I'd go over to his place, and we'd work through some sketches, and he'd show me some other stuff and ask questions. And, a few times you're asking me, why are you asking me? You're John Williams. And is it Joachim was the one who Brahms wrote the violin concerto for. Uh-huh. And he said, if it's good enough for Brahms and Joachim, it's good enough for you and me. That's Brahms great. Asked Joachim for input. And, he was always asking questions like ergonomically, if I do this, would that help change this? Or without, how long could you go in one breath with this and the phrasing and that and a tempo? And then one time we were working through some stuff and he got a call and he said, listen, this may take about 20 minutes, but where I'll be, go ahead and play if you want. It's not going to bother me, but just, it'll be about 20 minutes. I hope you don't mind. Said, of course. So I'm playing and I'm doing some stamp and, playing some pedal notes and everything. He comes back in, said, those low notes you were playing in about 5 minutes ago, when you're going down to the low concert D and the concert C, would it be possible to work that in some way? And I realized he was on the phone and he was hearing this, and something like caught his eye and was like, hmm. And it, I just realized there was nothing I could do that he wouldn't catch, that, if it was something that sparked something in him that he wouldn't, think of using. And that right there to me is just, he's always thinking, he's always searching, he's always on the move and seeking information and ideas. And that was incredibly inspiring for me.
How long did it take him to write the piece? Do you remember?
I first saw sketches of the piece, I want to say about 2 years before. Mm-hmm. And then it was done maybe about 4 months before the premiere. And then most people don't know this. The first performance of it was a performance at the Riviera Country Club in Pacific Palisades with a piano.
In episode 2, I'll be talking with Michael about working with John Williams on his concerto for trumpet and orchestra. He also talks a lot about David Zauter, who was second trumpet and personnel manager of the Cleveland Orchestra. Zauter actually influenced Steven Spielberg in the making of Schindler's List. He also talks about cornets versus trumpets in terms of sound, pranks, some great pranks that happened with David Zauter during performances of Ein Heldenleben. Talks also about learning music when he was a student and how that possibly differs from the way students learn music today. And finally, I asked Mike about what he thought the greatest performance that he played with the Cleveland Orchestra was.